Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Controls Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff, stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy, how are you?
I'm very, very well. Very, very well, actually.
So you've been playing with a rock star recently as well, haven't you?
I might have, yes. I've been doing something I can't really talk about, but just a bit of recording with someone we really want to get on here one day, Pete Townsend.
Yeah, I know. What a lovely man he is.
Oh, my God, what a lovely... It was... what a brain. It was basically like being at a three-day TED Talk with occasional music playing.
It's nice to know, you know, when a guy's in his mid-70s, he's still got, you know, a lot of planning and a lot of excitement and adrenaline.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a million things going on. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So, funnily enough, very near to the birthplace of the man we're about to speak to.
Of course, which is, he comes from Swindon, doesn't he?
He comes from Swindon, yeah, which has a famous, Pete was telling me about this, and I actually found myself on it, which is a thing called the Magic Roundabout, which is the most confusing thing in the world, which is a giant roundabout with a roundabout off every exit.
And how do you go around Zebedee?
It's literally, so your sat nav is like, take the first, second, third, fourth, fifth.
Justin Hayward is our guest today from the Moody Blues, obviously, and you know, solo work as well. But, you know, I've just been delving into the Moody Blues. Extraordinary amount of hit records. You know, they were the first act ever to have a hit in three decades.
That's right,
top 10 hit in the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, mostly all written by Justin.
By Justin, yeah. And also, and I've got absolutely groundbreaking in terms of concept recording and I don't quite get the prog kudos they deserve, I feel.
They don't. And in fact, having a listen, there's the opening track of, I think it's On the Threshold of a Dream, their third album, which was 1969, starts with voices and clocks ticking. Where have I heard that before?
Yeah. Good point.
But 70 million albums this guy.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
This band have sold. Extraordinary journey. I've known Justin for a long time. Beautiful man. And he's going to be talking to us from Italy, it seems, today. Not Swindon at all.
Oh, Swindoni.
I think in Italy they go round roundabouts both ways at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello.
Hi, Justin.
Hi there. Hello, Guy.
Thanks for sorting this out. What are you doing in Italy, Justin?
Alberto and I work together. We've been working together for like 25 years. So don't believe him when he says he's not a musician. He's Italian. It's like before the European Cup. They didn't say, we are the champions. Football's coming home. They didn't say any of that before. That's right, yeah. So after, they were like, yeah, great.
Where in Italy are you?
Genoa.
Oh, how very nice, I presume.
Yes, it's lovely, yeah.
And we must we'll confess to knowing each other quite well. We're in a little organisation along with Tim Rice and various other people, Mike Batten, who songwriters of distinction, or Society of Distinguished Songwriters, which comes out of SODS, right?
Yeah. The acronym is very much different to the words that make it up.
We both had the joy of being king, didn't we, Gary, at different times?
We have.
I've attended a few of those events, and I must say they are fabulous affairs. Certainly great music.
Yeah, and it's nice, guys who get up on stage who maybe have never been front men, who certainly aren't singers, well, apart from you and me, obviously, Justin, but you know, but people who have just been songwriters who get up and sing their songs.
Yeah, that's right.
It can be tragic as well as beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, you should never really follow one of them, because it's so very touching when a writer who is not a performer does his own song, because it brings out something in the song. We practice it, don't we? It's you and I so much that it's almost too slick. It's like yes, and we're on, and we know what we're doing. But when there's a doubt about it, that people are kind of worried about it, it's so beautiful. Yeah.
One of the guys who's part of this is Marty Wilde, and what I didn't know before I started researching you is that's how you started. You were in Marty Wilde's band.
Yes. So when I left school, my parents were both teachers, and they wanted me to get my 5 O-levels, which I did. And then I was answering ads in the Melody Maker routinely, just firing them off to everybody. And I remember this one ad. It said, name singer looking for a guitar player. And I was working in an office in Swindon for about 3 or 4 months, and I had a reply from somebody, I can't remember who it was, for me to go up to Blackheath in East London. And
hang on, wasn't it Eric Burden from the...
That was the next one.
I jump ahead.
I know, it's ridiculous.
That's right. So I went up to a house. So I was 17. I went up to a house in Blackheath, and Marty Wilde opened the door. And as you know, Gary, Marty is 6'5". I'm 6'2", and I spent the next 18 months feeling shorter.
Yeah.
I was with him for about 18 months, yeah.
When I met people in the past, they'd always say, you're much taller than I thought, because they always saw me standing next to the 6'4" Tony Hadley and thought I was some sort of small guy.
Yes.
What were you doing if it was 18 months with Marty Wilde? What did that entail, Justin?
Well, Marty was really trying to do stuff around a new idea. So it was Marty, his wife Joyce, who was in the Vernon's Girls, who were a singing group from all girl group from Liverpool, formed by the Vernon's.
Anything to do with the pools?
It was to do with the Vernon's pools, yeah. And anyway, Marty was just trying to create something new. When I first went, there was a drummer there as well, but then Marty realised that wherever we went, if the two of us were playing guitar, that I got the job. Anyway, I got the job. So, and then they'd usually, the clubs that he was playing, there'd usually be a drummer and a bass player and a piano player. So he could just tell them the chords. And so we were doing a lot of working men's clubs. We did a combined services entertainment tour. We did a summer season at Great Yarmouth, which I loved. It was fantastic. And of course, Marty was in the Larry Parnes stable at Rock and Roll.
That's classes. Why he was called Wild.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, yes. And yes, his real name's Smith. But yes, so I was in the company of all of those, you know, of Billy Fury, Johnny Gentle, Joe Brown was the one who didn't change his name, but
I would have been Gary Gorgeous, I'm sure. That would have been my name. I don't know what Guy would have been.
Johnny Alsatian, I think, would have been me.
Yes. Yeah. It was brilliant anyway to be around that office and in near Marble Arch and I met Danny Williams as well, who did that wonderful version of Moon River. He was also in that stable and of guys.
And how long had you been a guitar player for, Justin? What had been your ambitions?
Oh, well, then I started playing guitar. I pestered my parents to do something musically. I loved the English hymnal when I was a boy, and because I come from a family with quite a strong faith, and my father trained for the priesthood before the war, and then I was always involved with the Anglican Church, and I kind of knew how it worked. But I loved the English hymnal, and I loved those melodies. And then I just knew I wanted to be in music. And of course, when we were young, I saw pictures of guitars, like in the newspapers, and just photographs of people, and then it's like I really want to do that. And I pestered my parents, and when I was 8, they bought me a ukulele, and then after another 2 years of pestering, they bought me a guitar, and I kind of knew how to play it anyway, and because through the ukulele. And then, as you know, it's just practice, isn't it? And then I was in local groups. I was always the forming local groups in Swindon. And by the time I was, I suppose, 13, I had myself a 335, just like the one. That's probably a 345 behind you, actually.
No, it's 355.
355? Is it the stereo?
Well done for busting him, because he got it out specially, because you're
yes.
on.
And it looks like a posh.
Hang on, you had a 335.
I did, yes, from Morris Plackett, yeah.
Ah, oh, Morris Plackett, of course.
Yeah,
but
must have
been
about
13.
Yeah,
that's a posh guitar for a 13-year-old.
Yeah, no, I had a nice guitar at 13. I had my 335, I think, when I was about 14. And then
it's 15 according to the internet.
Is it? Okay.
Which obviously knows better than you.
Yes, I'm sure they're right, yeah. And I had an AC30 as well. I was just earning good money around Swindon. It was a good, fantastic music scene, semi-pro. It was great. Yeah.
And what was the music you were listening to?
I knew that, of course, you know, I come up with the generation. First of all, the voice that really got me was Johnny Ray.
You probably the Nabob of Sob.
Do you know who Johnny Ray was?
Yeah, we have. Yeah,
of course.
The Nabob of Sob.
Okay.
Is that what they call him?
Yeah. I'll work that one out later, yes.
Crying.
Because he cried.
Yes, okay. He was cruelly outed as well, I think, which was awful at the time.
But you know what? I just want to stop you there, Justin, because there's elements of Johnny Ray in your voice now. I think about it. You have that. Mm-mm. You have that way of that break in your voice that you do. Say in the big section of Nights in White Satin. When my dog's trying to impersonate it. Hang on one second. Get out.
He's after that 355.
Whoa, I love you. You know the way you do that. There's a Johnny Ray element in there. I can hear it anyway.
Well, so, and then, of course, Elvis. I knew I couldn't be Elvis, but when Buddy came along, I knew that was what I wanted to do. And so, Buddy Holly was just my complete hero. Yeah, and the Everlys too. But it was very difficult getting hold of music. The Light Programme didn't play very much. Luxembourg, you know, me and my brother in the bedroom with the little crystal set trying to get it at certain times of night. It wasn't very easy to source, really, and we couldn't afford records. But my grandfather had left me a selection of like 78 records and things like Inner Persian Market and really odd sort of oriental things. And that was quite a revelation too. But of course, when Buddy Holly came along, I just was like a sponge for it, yeah.
He wrote his own songs, which
yes,
no one did they?
Yes, he was the writer, the rhythm guitar player, the singer. He was like the group member from hell that I was going to be. You do this, do that.
But it's interesting what guys said, because obviously it's one thing being a guitar player, but it's another thing entirely deciding you're going to write music. Was that something you'd started before you went to the Moody Blues? It must be, because the songs you start writing for Moody Blues are so good.
I came to the Moody Blues as a songwriter. So it was with Marty that told me to survive in the business, you've got to have your own style, and that means writing your own song. So I started writing when I was with Marty, and then he was writing, as you know, Gary, he was writing actually under another name, because he had such a terrible publishing deal that he was writing under a pseudonym. But... So I started writing when I was with Marty, and it was my own stuff that then I sent to Eric Burdon, somebody in Eric Burdon's office, my own songs and demos of me, because I knew somebody in that office. That's all.
Because I was just wondering, I wondered what demos would have comprised of back then and where you would have done them.
I did some things at a couple of things at Regent Sound, just little places around Denmark Street. But being the wonderful thing,
London by this, but you have
Marty.
Yeah,
Marty was London, West London, East London, West London. That was it. That was 17.
You name it.
I was
East
placed
London, West London.
Yeah, I left Swindon. I was in London. That's it. I wasn't going back to Swindon. Okay. You know. I have been back to Swindon a couple of times, but not to live.
He got stuck on the roundabout and ended up coming home.
Yeah, I was in Swindon last weekend, funnily enough, because it has that magic roundabout, it's called, on the edge, which is a roundabout surrounded by roundabouts.
He's looking confused, Guy.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I know exactly the magic roundabout. But I was there 2 years ago with my own little solo group, and a guy came up to me and he said, I know he used to like you, but you weren't bad tonight. I thought that's a compliment in Swindon.
Well, it's all right if it's that way round. The worst is when it's the other one. You used to be great.
Yeah. Do you know who I was?
I was very lucky. Swindon was a fantastic musical scene in those days, in the 50s and early 60s. It was brilliant, and I got to play in the local bands at a place called McIlroy's and the Locarno in Swindon, and supported all of these people, opened up for all of the great acts. So I saw all of these early 60s acts coming through. It was joyous. Well, from the Hollies and from just people like the Giants and the comedy act. I've put the penny in at the top. It'll take a while to come down through the machine. Yeah.
Just a bit.
Baron Knights?
Exactly. The Baron Knights. Every couple of months, the Baron Knights would come round. And, Brian Poole, Tremolos, that kind of stuff.
Were the Moody Blues someone... Because obviously Go Now was a massive hit.
Yes.
You weren't on that record. You weren't in that band.
No. So I mean, Lodgy weren't in that band.
The concept of playing, of being asked to join a band older than you, super successful.
Yeah.
That must have been quite extraordinary for you.
Well, it was super successful with one record that the managers who'd put the group together originally, it was like a boy band, the Moody's. It was picked by... couple of managers and a finance guy in Birmingham to put a group together that looked nice, that would be good, and around Denny Cordell, the record producer who had the song Go Now, which was Bessie Banks.
Yeah. But it's funny because the first Bessie Banks album doesn't even sound like sort of Go Now. Most of it, it's real rinky-dink R&B.
Yes, that's Isn't right. It? That's so, right. So the after Go Now, Denny, it was kind of whoop, dump. It's done. And Denny left. And
so
Clint,
this is Denny Lane, who ended
Denny
up
Lane.
Playing with Wings.
Yep. Yes, Denny Lane left. He left with a wonderful song, which was called Say You Don't Mind. But that was why he left. He thought, I can do this better on my own, I think.
Say you don't mind that one. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know whether he could do it better on his own, okay. But he was right. And so he'd left, and Clint Warwick, the original bass player, who just didn't want to do it. Wasn't his real name, Clint. Clint Warwick was not his real name.
Had an extraordinary bass style. He strummed it like a guitar.
Yeah.
But was Mike Pinder, the keyboard player, and Ray Thomas, the flautist?
So there was three people, Mike Pinder, Graham Edge, and Ray Thomas, yes. And, that was it. I had the call from Mike Pinder to meet. He'd heard my stuff that Eric Burden had sent me.
What would those songs be? Were any of the songs that you sent in things that ended up being Moody Blues?
There was one song which was called Fly Me High that silence that you wouldn't have heard of, right. But that we recorded before Nights, yeah. But I joined a group with a debt to the Decca, because the guys who formed it, the manager of Financial Guy, had run off with all the money. So Mike, Ray and Graham were after I'd got to know them for about a week, and it's like, right, there's no money, you know, but we have a debt to Decca, which we had. So that was the situation.
Which you've just taken on.
Yes. me and John I didn't know John either. All the others were from
John
Birmingham.
Lodge.
All the others were from working class families in Birmingham. I was from middle class socialists in Swindon, and they were from working class conservatives. That's the way life is, you know. Yeah,
must have made for a lively chat in the van.
Ah, life was
early
wonderful.
Early days of Twitter.
Life was wonderful, you know, because you could have philosophy differences when you didn't have anything. It didn't make any difference. Your philosophy of life could be completely different and wonderful as long as you didn't have anything. We were in the van together.
How old
do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How old are you at this point, Justin? Not now, I mean then.
Yeah, then.
Yeah, right now, this point.
I was 19. I was 19,
so
yeah.
What you're about to make is, and I think we should just kind of explain it slightly to anyone who doesn't know the album, is you're about to make an album that is so extraordinary, that is going to completely change the landscape of music. You know, invent prog concept albums, if you like. This album, Days of Future Past, which to this day is just one of the most extraordinary pieces of work I've ever played as an album. And it was full of orchestrations and storytelling, and it was a concept album as well. How did all of this begin? For this boy who joins
Moody Blues. Yeah, it's because there's also one particularly interesting angle to do with Decca on this, isn't there?
Well, Decca were actually they were run by elderly gentlemen headed by Sir Edward Lewis, and they had a consumer division as well, so they had made stereo units. And if anyone of my age remembers driving down the old A3, they just see Decca, 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 the amount of real estate that they owned, pressing plants and everything. And of course, they had the second largest classical catalogue in the world, Decca. But we also had a debt to them. So they had a call on us, really. They didn't think much of my songs pre Days of Future Past, but then they asked us to do a demonstration, to demonstrate stereo, to do a demonstration record of stereo. They wanted to demonstrate that stereo could be as interesting for rock and roll as it was for classical music, which they really monopolized, apart from Deutsche Grammophon. Deutsche Grammophon and Decca were the two that owned all the great masters of classical work. And so they wanted to sell their own equipment, it's honorable purpose, and to try and get people who bought rock and roll records or pop music, which was confined totally to mono and to a dancette. It still stayed confined to a dancette for me until about 1970. But to demonstrate that stereo could be interesting for pop and rock and roll, yeah.
So it had to be an audiophile record. It was like a, because it was a demonstration record.
Yes.
It?
So it had to demonstrate.
Which was great, which meant it was whatever it was going to be was going to have to be fantastically produced.
Yes, exactly. So
quite a nice thing to place to start from.
Yes, of course. I spent. It's like Gary knows that Barry Mason used to say, you know, if I'd have known how wonderful the last 60 years would have been, I'd have enjoyed every moment. But as it is, it's stress all the way. When I turned up in Decca, because we were never invited into the control room, but they would play it back to you in the studio, and I would think, oh, it's kind of lovely, but it's not very loud, and there's stuff over there and stuff in the middle and this big soundscape. And what I was really wanted in my heart of hearts was to do a thumping mono record.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
But
yeah,
Deckard weren't interested in that.
So Peter Knight was the guy who did all the orchestration for this album. And Mike Pinder, your incredible keyboard player, who's one of the first people in the world to own... one of the first to own a Mellotron.
He worked at Mellotronics before he was in the band.
He introduced Paul and John and got them to buy their first Mellotron, which they used on Strawberry Fields, etc.
Yes, we were able to just nip down the road from Broadhurst Gardens to Abbey Road when we wanted, and particularly Mike, because they had a few things in common. Substances and all sorts of and equipment and stuff, you know, had a few things in common. Yes,
but it's funny because you had the Mellotron, which became a real thing for you.
The Mellotron was what the instrument.
But you actually had access to a real orchestra, because some of the orchestral stuff on Days of Future Past is extraordinary. But there's one bit which I think in the lunchtime section, where you suddenly go into this piece of music which sounds like it's from a travelogue or a newsreel or something.
Oh, yes.
You can imagine a voiceover going, well, here's a crew who like things shipshape and Bristol fashion.
Exactly. Yeah. The original meeting was with an exec that they had called Michael Dacre Barclay, and he was very posh, and his idea
you
was...
you think?
Dacre Barclay, yes. And... his idea was that we should do a rock version of Dvorak.
That's right, yeah.
And the real orchestra, with Peter Knight, who they also had on contract, would do the real Dvorak. Peter Knight came to see us in... So that was suggested to us. And we were like, oh, what? Yeah, okay, whatever. And so Peter Knight came to see us at the 100 Club in Oxford Street. And we saw him the next day in the pub just up from Decca on the embankment, and he said, "You boys are never going to get this Dvorak thing together, but your songs are great. And what if we just take your songs and I take those themes and we make them into something?" And the executive producer was called Hugh Mendel. Huge Muddle, we used to call him, but he was a genius. look up Hugh Mendel, you'll see what he did. He's a genius and a lovely man. And he sort of went along with that idea. So we recorded all our songs in about 2 or 3 days, I think, in sessions, just simple four-track, maybe bouncing to another four-track. And the orchestra was done in one session. The whole thing, record, was done in one session on a Saturday from 10 to 1.
Wow.
And they broke up. All of the classical musicians knew that if Peter Knight was doing it, it was going to be lovely. So they all behaved and they all played the parts exactly as he'd written them. And that was it. I was the only one of the group that was in the studio. I'm not saying I'm the only one who bothered to go, but I was the only one who went on that Saturday. And they did it. They did one complete run-through. They did a practice. They did a complete run-through. They had a tea break, and then they did a take of the 47 minutes, and that was it.
I have to say, one of the greatest, greatest songs ever written, and it's been a real joy listening to it again. You know, Knights in White Satin is just incredible piece of work. Funnily enough, when I was a kid, I always thought it was spelt Knights, because I envisage these knights riding, wearing white satin, but maybe that's just me.
No, it was me as well. I was hoping there'd be a double. Yes, of course, if you look at the front of the album sleeve. Yeah. Yes.
Because I hate to jump ahead, because didn't you appear in The Simpsons, but you were called the Satin Knights? yes,
we did appear in The Simpsons, yes, and we were called the Satin Knights, and we were on the poster. We were supporting the Moody Blues, yeah. Yes, it was fantastic. But that is an interesting thing. To be in The Simpsons, by the way, is the one thing, you know, hallelujah, it's life-changing.
But for these boys fantastic. In the Moody Blues, you're a gift from heaven. This 19-year-old kid arrives, and he's written Knights in White Satin. Just talk us through that writing process.
Yeah.
If you can remember.
Yes, well, it's a funny thing. It's the same for you, both of you. Things happen in your life, and you're asked to remember about 4 minutes that happened to you 60 years ago. I don't know what I know anymore. But Mike Pinder was a great writer. He was a great writer and a great rhythm player. And, of course, he got the Mellotron. He wanted to use it. He was a piano player. He realised that wasn't going to work. We all knew we couldn't sing rhythm and blues once Denny had gone. So we were just doing something different. We were doing our own thing, getting our own following by the time Peter Knight had seen us. And then Mike had written a song called Dawn is a Feeling, which I really loved, and he asked me to sing. And I came back from a gig one night, and I was living with Graham and our two girlfriends in two rooms in Bayswater, and I just sat on the side of the bed, and I knew the other guys were wanting me to have a song for the next day. We were recording in Barnes. And
Olympic, was that?
No, we were recording in a church hall. In a church hall in Barnes. We were rehearsing, not recording. No, we weren't recording. And nothing like that happened until much later. But we were just rehearsing this. And I knew they were expecting me to have something to put in our act. We did a sort of 45 minutes of rhythm and blues, because you do 45-minute spots in those days. 45 of rhythm and blues, and then 45 of our own songs, which often died. The rhythm and blues, we were all right with, you know, but we were rubbish at it. So anyway, I came back and after a gig, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I thought the other guys, they want to have something that I've to play them tomorrow that we can learn to put in the set. Mike had written this lovely Dawn is a Feeling, and I just thought about the night and I don't know, it just all came out. It's like 4 or 5 minutes, and it's just the basic thing with the chords and the words. And I went into the rehearsal room in Barnes the next day, and I had this big old 12-string, and I played it to the guys, and they were really nonplussed. They just sort of said, it was like, okay. And then Mike said, play it again.
Got anything else?
Yeah, got anything else? Yeah, but people.
I have to say, because
that's the story of our lives, isn't it?
Tony Hadley does lots of interviews where he says, well, when Gary first played True, I just thought, well, that's all right. I didn't think much of it. So it's extraordinary, isn't it? That
people say, that's the story of our lives, isn't it? Got anything else? Yeah, you play it. It's meant so much to you. Anyway, I played, and then Mike said, play it again. So I went nice in my sudden, and he, on his melodrama, went da 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 da. And then suddenly, all the other guys were, oh, that's interesting. And that changed the way people saw it.
Oh, now we like it.
Now we like it, yeah. They could kind of see their parts, I think, once they'd got that rhythmic da 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 da. Yeah.
Actually, but that is an interesting point, though, because it is true when you're presented. You know, speaking as a musician here, is when you're presented with a song in its basic form, I think a lot of it is people have a thinking, yeah, well, where am I in this?
Yes, that's right.
Not seeing the big picture, so.
That's right.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Guy, I think it changed the ballad form, you know, because, you know, you think after...
Yeah, but there's nothing like it. There was nothing... The only thing I can think of in the same ballpark is like would be something like... White A Shade of Pale, but even that's...
No, that's very... too bluesy, really. Yeah. Too bluesy, yeah, yeah, yeah. But although it has the Bach keyboard.
None of us thought anybody would ever hear it. It was then this whole idea about the demonstration record come, and none of us ever thought any, you know, it'll just be a demonstration stereo record, that'll be it. But we recorded it in the April or May of 67 for the BBC, and we were going up the M1 or the A1 in our van. And it came on, we recorded it for a program called Easy Beat on the Friday, and they played it on the Saturday, and we were going up the motorway, and we listened to it, and we pulled over the van, and we said, there's something spooky about that. You know, it's not a pop song, it's just kind of spooky. There's something eerie about it. And that was when people started to sort of think that kind of stuff. There's nothing happening, but it's something.
Yeah.
Because it was when it really hit was when it was re-released in 72, wasn't it?
It came out.
And I literally remember the first time I heard it. Then was Hugh. I was 10. I was with my family in a Greek restaurant in Camberwell, and I remember it's just one of those things. Going, I've never heard anything like this. This is incredible.
Oh, that's so sweet. I love that. It affected you that much.
Oh, yeah, that is it wonderful. Absolutely did. That's wonderful.
That re-release. That came on the back of you having, you know, major success in America later on, didn't it?
Yeah. The thing that happened to us was that we went to America for Bill Graham in the winter of 67, 68. We opened for everybody. We did a tour with Canned Heat. We were everybody's opening act. But Days of Future Past and the second album that we made, In Search of the Lost Chord, were perfect for FM radio. They had nothing FM. They had things like It's a Beautiful Day or some Buffalo Springfield things were in stereo. The Beatles, I was really disappointed with the stereo that they put together for their albums. And because
they used to do that weird thing of all the voices on one side.
But they didn't care either, did they? They spent 6 weeks doing the mono mix of Sgt. Pepper and one day doing the stereo mix.
Even if they ever turned up for the stereo mix or somebody did it, But of course, in America, for FM, they had this wonderful soundscape that our stuff was just perfect for. Yeah.
Psychedelia is what was kind of what is what you sort of became part of it. And it's just, I wonder where Pink Floyd were in this time, in the timing, in the evolution. I mean, because there's without a doubt, Search of the Lost Chord is a very psychedelic record. I mean, yeah. It has, you know, stuff about Timothy Leary, and it has spoken word.
Who we knew, who we'd met on that first tour, Timothy Leary. So we knew him, yes. I went to his ranch and stayed for a whole weekend.
No. Yeah. I had dinner at his house once, but
lovely. Yeah,
what a
character he was, wasn't he?
He was amazing. He was absolutely amazing. He signed me a picture.
Yeah,
extraordinary.
But Pink Floyd and the timing. I mean, you know, the UFO Club and all that stuff. I mean, where does it fit in?
Is it a question to me?
Yeah, is this a question to you, Justin? Would you say it's because people mentioned Pink Floyd here, but
yeah,
this is 1968 in Search of a Lost Chord. Are you just a bit ahead of it here?
We were, because we played with them. I remember them with Sid at we played with them at the Roundhouse, and the top of the bill wasn't us or them. It certainly wasn't us. And the top of the bill was a light show, and that's what people had come to see. So, yes, we were just slightly before, I think, but. Once we'd gone to America...
At least it wasn't Puppet Show.
Yes. Light shows were often top of the bill on tours. Yeah.
But did you all tuned in and dropped out, didn't you, at one point, to make this album?
Most of us did. I certainly did, yeah.
Was there an acid trip, the famous moment when it all changed?
You mean life or...?
No. When that inspired the music on this record.
Yeah. Well, there certainly was an acid trip that the four of us took, yes, that probably changed the way we thought about things and about the way we wrote. But we were just part of that. And when we got to America, of course, we were part of that youth culture. Some of these boys were going to Vietnam. You know, there was that whole kind of thing going on. And we were like the voice of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because you're having poetry on your albums, you know.
Yes,
weren't you?
Yes.
I mean, it's great, all that narration type thing, and they're great poems. I mean,
yes, it's Graham, our drummer, who was always the most precious member of the group.
It's always fun. You know, we need some poetry. Who are we going to get to write it? How about the drummer?
Yeah, that's a sentence you'd never have, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
What Guy was saying is fascinating. How daring that was to put poetry on your records.
Yes. Well, Graham was such an ideas man, and he couldn't write a song. I always said to him, you know, because we were all trying to write songs, and then after me and Mike sort of kicked that ball down, booted that ball down the pitch, and then I would always say to Graham, yeah, but it's just too many words, man. You know, it's the sound of the words that you can't say certain words in a song. It has to be the sound of them that gets like, ah, yee, yow, you know, kind of stuff. True. It works. And they wanted some kind of, Decca wanted some kind of way to link all of those songs together on Days of Future Past. And Graham came up with that, Breathe Deep, The Gathering Grief, and it was absolutely beautiful. Mike Pinder he said it, lying on his back in the dark in the studio. And it was fantastic, yeah. He had such a beautiful voice, speaking voice. I used to call him 007 Pindy because he'd convince me to do the most ridiculous things. But Justin, you know, what we should do is this. And I was like, yeah. And so I'd head off on all sorts of reckless schemes just by being hypnotized by somebody's voice. Yes.
I mean, I mentioned to Guy earlier about on your next album, on The Threshold of Dreams, it starts with not only voices talking, but it starts with clocks ticking. And, I think you were setting, you know, there's definitely inspiring future work by Pink Floyd at that moment.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, the use of soundscapes and all of that in Moody Blues stuff, that was...
Yes.
Again, yeah. you were... I did also... Can I just also say that I think... Some of the stuff I hear you do, which has obviously has San Francisco inspiration behind it, influence. It seems to be like it's the sort of stuff that Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young took on and did later. We have to remember that, you know, Graham Nash was playing in the Hollies.
But actually that's the key point, Gary. I think is the fact that you were doing all this stuff before all those people.
Were we?
It's like I can't really see, you know, what would be influencing you other than just you influencing other people?
It was just that we were such different people, and I think we had such different philosophies of life. I come back to that, and we were trying to express those in a way, snobbish and all sorts of annoying philosophies that we were putting forward, and psychedelic philosophies, and we were on a kind of search for some kind of enlightenment. Yes, it was a search for enlightenment, personally, and in our own lives. Some of
meditation
us.
Was something you did as well.
Yes, we did that with the Maharishi's team. Yes, with the TM team, at a lovely house that George had bought for the Transcendental Meditation.
It was in
the back of Eaton Square somewhere. Gorgeous place, yeah. Yeah, you had to give them a week's wages to get
it. What's interesting is that you
be enlightened.
You all seem to write separately. It wasn't times when you... I mean, you obviously wrote most of the hit singles, so let's just say you were probably the best writer in the room.
There didn't seem
to be any kind of teaming up. You just brought your songs in. But there was still... they all made up what was the Moody Blues sound.
Yes. That's right. Though I can't deny that there was a kind of quota. You could only have so many, and then you have to let the other guy do it. And we all had different ways of doing it. I always wrote at home, so I always knew what I wanted. That's why, I wouldn't like to be on a session with me, because I'm going to say, you play that, and you do that, and that's it. Whereas the other guys would have a bit of a song where I'd say, why don't I do this? And it's like, oh, yeah, that's great. And... why don't you do that? And you'd struggle to kind of build it up. So it was just a different way of doing it. Me and Mike would always have songs prepared. It was just the way, as boys, I suppose, as a 17, 18-year-old, that's just the way I knew how to do it. I didn't want to take anything. I didn't want to take any chances in the studio.
Yeah.
Whereas some people can do that risk, can't they? Both of you know so well that some people will have a scrap and expect everyone else in the studio to build it up. And that's a great way of working too, because it brings out some brilliant pieces of arrangement.
But that must have happened to you occasionally. Surely someone must have brought something to the party that you weren't expecting. Or
Mike. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did, yeah. In every way. And a flute. You have to try and incorporate a flute all the time.
Yeah, and listening to the early stuff and with the flute and with the 12-string guitar, you now know where Genesis came from.
Lots of credit. I don't think anybody was listening to us.
I think, you know, people like Jethro Tull and Ian Anderson and Peter with his flute. There's a sort of pastoral quality to what you were doing.
Yeah.
Inspired. Yeah. Maybe it goes all the way back to your hymnal.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure we were that influential. I'm not sure that we can take credit, really, because we were always sort of fourth or fifth on the bill, and in those Melody Maker year things, best of the year, we were always like about sixth or seventh people's favourite group, you know.
But it is quite funny, just in that perception of the Moody Blues, and I know it's something that considering the stuff you were doing was incredibly psychedelic, was very revolutionary and sort of conceptual and doing all that stuff, and yet the perception of you as a band is something a lot more mainstream than, say, the Genesises and the proggy bands of the time.
Yes.
I was wondering why that was.
I think that may have something to do with in the 80s, we just changed, and Mike had left, and then Tony Visconti became our record producer. And I did what I'd really always wanted to do, was to make pop records. And that, I think if we'd have just stayed, if we'd have finished in 1973, we might have been in the Rolling Stones charts of good groups. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't. Because we had hits in the 80s and the early 90s, it was like, oh, no.
Well, I mean, hang on. Let's just give you credit where it's due. You had four UK number one albums, two US number one albums.
I think probably
what Guy's talking about is because you could still write a hit record. That was a period when it was the cardinal sin.
Which is the cardinal sin. Exactly.
You could go on Top of the Pops. You could go on Colour Me Pop. You know, you could make a concept album, but there was always a Justin Hayward track on there that would be a hit record. And one that you wrote later on, which is, you know, we have to talk about, which is one of the great records, is Question, which came on on a later album. What year was Question?
70, wasn't it?
Exactly. 70? Yeah, 70.
And what it does is it shows off your phenomenal guitar playing, which I can hear also on that great track on a previous album called Gypsy. Gypsy.
Oh, yeah.
Your sort of, you know, big strumming, sort of open tuning. How did you hear?
It's funny because there was a group that we knew called Trapeze, and Mel Galley, the guitar player, he learnt Question before he knew me in a normal tuning, and he was so choked when he saw me doing it. That's so fucking easy, because it was just an open C tuning. Yes, I had to, the night before, it was one of those things, Justin will come up with something. The night before the recording session, I still hadn't done it, but I had two songs in C. And I had this big old 12-string, and I tuned it to that open C tuning. And off, I put the two songs together, and off we went. I never expected anybody to pick up on it or like it, but
So one was up-tempo and one was slow.
There was a ballad and an up-tempo thing, and neither of them were finished. But they kind of, I just put them together, and it was like,
and again,
all right.
That's revolutionary for a single back then. This is, you know, years before Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So what year
people,
is this?
In America, people were doing stuff like that, though. Honestly, they really were.
But it was FM mid-60s. Radio. You know, we had Radio 1. They had, you know, they were...
Yes.
Their whole thing was based around album tracks.
You're right. Yeah.
No, you're right, Guy, because that song completely goes against the grain of the standard. I mean, in a way, I suppose, let's face it, Day in the Life did that as well, but not necessarily as a single. And in fact, you are your own Day in the Life, aren't you, really? But, you know, the way they took two songs and stuck them together,
you
did the same thing, Justin. Yeah.
One of the loveliest moments
we're all about showing off on here.
Yeah. was that I was at a PRS thing, and Noel Gallagher got an award, and I did too. And afterwards, Noel walked towards me, and I thought, oh dear, what's happening? and he said, never mind about that. When nights and such, and he said, that fucking Question, fucking brilliant. And wow. and I thought, oh, that's the greatest thing ever. I said, oh, thank you so much. And I was absolutely knocked out, because you kind of forget these things, but. Question was great for us because it was in that summer of 1970, in the early summer, and we were just about to do the Isle of Wight Festival, and that was huge. And we did it. The festival itself was a bit of a disaster. The fence came down. It became a free festival. Somebody jumped on stage and bashed Joni Mitchell in the face with the mic, and oh, it was all getting...
He wasn't from Spotify, was he?
I wondered if you were going to mention all that.
No, go on.
And we came on at sunset, and everybody just went, oh, that's so nice. You know, the whole, you could, like a big sigh of 450,000 people. Oh, it's the Moody's, and it's all going to be all right. You know, and we had Question, and it was just great, yeah. Fantastic.
Oh, that's beautiful. Actually, another thing, a little thing that has to, obviously, as a bass player, I have to mention on Quest, is that bass line is just superb.
Yeah.
No, it drives the whole thing.
Is
that yours?
It came out of the 12-string guitar. You can in the 12-string, you can play that in it. Yeah. So, yeah. It was born out of that 12-string.
So, was that your line? Did you instruct?
Who knows? who knows? I would definitely have had a lot to do with it saying, do that. John always knew that it was a good idea to, you know, you experiment with other things, but it's probably a good idea to do what he says. Do what I said. In the end.
Right. There's endless arty kind of experimentation, isn't there? Because in the album I remember as a kid, which was, you know, you had to have, was Every Good Boy Deserves Favour.
Yeah.
And it begins with this extraordinary piece of music, which is, I don't know, a couple of minutes long, and it goes from the beginning of music right up to the present day. That was the only track that all Moody Blues wrote together in the same...
Yes.
You have to add an addendum to that track every 5 years.
That's right, yes.
That's got a hip-hop bit.
Yes. It's like that's... yes, that's right, yeah. That would be fun. And it's like that picture of evolution, isn't it? Of Neanderthal man.
Yeah. So start with Jimi Hendrix and end up with Ed Sheeran.
Leave that one alone.
No. How daring is this group still? You're not thinking we need singles, that's what we need.
No. No, we're not. Because London Records were so happy for us to make albums and album tracks and to sell the whole album. And yes, you could put the album on, and there weren't even any scrolls, are they called, you know, on the vinyl. That was a thing that Decca did away with as well. So that you couldn't really...
What, the gaps?
Yes, between tracks, right. Because they all segued into one to the other. Totally. When Alberto and I came to remaster things, it was totally annoying, wasn't it, Alberto? Because we couldn't find where one ended and where the next one started. We had to remaster it recently. We went back to the four-track of a lot of things, didn't we, of the original four-track? That was quite interesting, wasn't it, how we did that? Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, that's a problem with CDs, wasn't it? Because CDs had to have tracks.
Yes, yes, exactly. They had to have a registration place on it, yeah.
Justin, let's talk about you and your relationship with John Lodge, you know, the bass player, and because you went on and you formed a band together in a sort of hiatus of Moody Blues. And can I just say John Lodge doesn't get the credit he deserves all the time, does he?
I would go along with that, yeah.
You know, great... Great bass player, but he and a great songwriter as well, because he wrote I'm Just a Singer in a Rock and Roll Band, which is one of your big hits. And
that same kind of bass lick as well as Question, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
that was great stuff. Song.
Yeah,
but the Blue Jays album, what I loved and I didn't know is the Blue Guitar, which was a big hit. Brown I remember
guitar and,
has 10cc as your backing band.
Yes, it's only 10cc on them too. I recorded it before Blue.
That's
Jays.
All you need, mate. You don't need anything else.
What?
That's all you need. You don't need more.
Yes.
You say it's only 10cc.
Yes. Yes. Well, it was a single tracked 10cc. Yes. Oh, they were called. I think they might have been called Hot Legs at the time. Yeah.
Oh, is that when they were still the sort of doo-wop? Sort of
it was recorded before that, yes, and I had it in the can, that song and that track, and then before the Blue Jays album, and it was only after the Blue Jays album that Decca desperately wanted something, a single, to follow up the Blue Jays album, and then we put out Blue Guitar, yeah.
But hang on, it's Graham.
Wasn't that album originally going to be, was it with Mike or with something? It wasn't going to be with John.
Yes. We came to the end of a long tour in 74, and I kind of knew that the whole thing, we were drifting apart. Nothing was said that couldn't be unsaid, thankfully, but I knew there were just no plans made, and that's always frightening in a group. Both of you know how frightening that is, isn't it, when there's nothing in that date book.
That or a pandemic.
Yes, yeah. Who knew? Yeah, a guy across the street from me, I remember when that started, he shouted, hey, and I was like, me? Yeah. He said, how long do you think this is going to last? It was on that first weekend in March, you know. I said, I'll give it 2 weeks. And I've seen him just like, arsehole, told me 2 weeks.
But if a pandemic strikes, find someone in a rock band to tell you how long it's going to last.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, so at the end of the tour, I knew that Mike wanted to do something with me, and he was living in Los Angeles, and so I got together with him, and then Tony Clark, the producer, turned up, and with John, and this is just these things are car crashes, aren't they? So it's everybody has a different opinion of what happens. Gary, it's the same for you in a group. Everybody has a different story.
Oh, they do, and a different lawyer as well.
We never had different lawyers, but I know exactly what you mean. It's a different story. But when Tony and John turned up, Mike took me in the kitchen. He said, I don't want to do it like that anymore. And I said, well, I haven't got the courage to kind of say. He said, well, I'm out. I'm going to do something else. So that was that. And then John and Tony and I came back to England and we did the Blue Jays album. And that was nice. We had formed a great group and the whole thing could continue. But straight after that, I realised what I wanted to do was just do my own. I was kind of doing my own things anyway within the Blue Jays records, you know, because there was other musicians on it that never worked with.
But what's extraordinary is Mike Pindett. Yeah. He never came back to music properly, did he? I mean, he's dropped out. No. He's still around. He's 80 now, I think.
I think so, yeah.
But, yes.
That's
you know,
right.
Give it what he did. He didn't, because Patrick Mraz took over from
Patrick from came him. In for 10 years and played some wonderful stuff, yeah. Yes, but Mike will always be kind of my inspiration, really, for those early things. And I still think, would he like it? You know, kind of stuff, kind of thing. Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Was it what would Mike do?
Yeah, what would
what would Mike do?
What would Mike do if? What would Mike think?
Well, no, I mean, exactly. When you're writing something or whatever.
You know? I guess we should talk about War of the Worlds, shouldn't we, Guy?
Mike would always love Jeff, it. Mike would always play because the basic track would always be drums, bass, guitar, and Mike would always play tambourine, and so he would hold the whole thing together with a tambourine groove, and that was the most important part of the glue of the original backing tracks.
We should talk about War of the Worlds.
Okay.
Yes.
Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, because this became a touring thing for you as well, didn't it?
Yes, eventually. Yes.
How did that come about? Were you approached for that?
Well, this is so I was in my house in West London one day and the phone rang and it was an American voice on the end of the line and he said, "Are you the guy who sang Nights in White Satin?" And I thought it's probably best to check, isn't it, if you're calling somebody in a group.
But if you say no, sorry, wrong number.
Yes, yes. No, that was the other guy.
Just keep calling people. Go, are you the bloke who sang White Satin?
That was the Baron Knights in White Satin.
Yes, yes. The great thing about The Simpsons, where we were playing was a casino called the Quicksands, which was a wonderful name, casino. Yeah, and, so... he said, because I've got a song that I think would be right for you and like you to consider. So he sent it round to my house and I listened to it the next day, unenthusiastically. But then there happened to be a guy around at my house who worked at the Moody Blues record shop in Cobham that we had that was underneath our office there. And
had a record shop?
We had a record shop, yes. Well, we had an office and then there was a shop underneath it. So
it just sold Moody Blues records?
No. You could go and listen to all sorts of records there in a lovely booth. It was gorgeous.
Isn't that beautiful?
And because we made it nice. And then you'd go down the road and buy them cheaper at Woolworths. So that was it. It wasn't really a great a business model. But it was lovely. And anyway, this young lad worked there. And he was making a cup of tea and he came into the lounge where I was listening and he listened to the demo of the song all the way through. And when it finished, he said to me, "You ought to do that, mate. It's perfect for you." And I thought, what else am I doing? Not much, really. And so I went down to AdVision behind Oxford Street and I met Jeff Wayne and his engineer, who was also confusingly called Jeff. And I met Jeff and Jeff and I heard the lovely track there was me, Herbie Flowers, Chris Spedding, Joe Partridge,
Wow.
You know, and it was fantastic. So I did that, and then a couple of days, did Forever Autumn, did like a zillion vocals on it with every, the third, the fifth, the seventh, the ninth, you know, every possible conceivable harmony, which I enjoyed doing. And then Jeff Wayne called me back a couple of days later and said, there's another track, it was called Eve of the War, so I did that too. And I heard nothing at all for about 2 years, and then I had a call from a promo guy at CBS, and he said, do you remember that thing you did with Jeff Wayne? This happens to you, Guy, I'm sure. You remember that thing you did with so-and-so? And I said, yeah. I said, nobody ever called. He said, well, they've released it as a single. It's called Forever Autumn. And if you do Top of the Pops next week, it'll get in the top 30. We'll all have fun and it'll be great. I did. We did. And it's been absolutely fantastic. You know, so that's the way life goes, yeah, isn't it? But that's a promotion guy's job, isn't it? Do Top of the Pots. We'll all have fun. It'll be great. We're getting the top 30.
Yeah. Yeah, Guy, do you know how that song started? Did you find that out? How that Forever Autumn started? It started as an ad for Lego.
Okay. Because that's where Jeff Wayne came from, wasn't it? It was like no one really knew him before that. He was just this ad guy who somehow managed to assemble this incredible cast of people to
Richard Burton on that record. It's just quiet.
Yeah, I beg your pardon.
I was the song thoughts of Richard Burton, who narrated the whole thing. Phil Lynott was on it too, yeah.
Beautiful lyrics by Gary Osborne, a friend of ours, right?
Wonderful. What a song. What a gift of a song too, yes. But Gary Osborne and Paul Vigrass, yeah. And Jeff Wayne, yeah.
And you're going back out on the road with it again?
Yeah, so I did, when it came on stage, I did the touring version for 7 or 8 years in character, with the costume of the H.G. Wells story of the War of the Worlds. So it's set in the 1890s, as you know. So
yeah, I've seen the show. Oh, actually, okay. not with you in
and
it, yeah.
Probably Herbie was in it when you saw it. Then was he?
No, I saw it just a few. It was after me, because I bumped into Jason Donovan on Brighton Seafront, and he said, "I'm doing this. Come along." So I saw that version.
Okay, and. Yes, when I was with it, it was again with Herbie and Chris. Yeah, so I did it for quite a long time, and then they asked me to come back, and I said, I'm too old for the part, and said, oh, well, Jeff's older than you, so... Yeah, so it was Alberto that said to me, hey, you'll never be asked again, will you, Joss? And I said, I probably won't, no. So
what do you play, the juvenile...
But how can you be too old to be Thoughts?
No, but he's playing the...
That was Alberto's point. That was exactly what Alberto said, you see, which I thought was brilliant.
You're not playing the juve lead, are you? Is that the aging juvenile lead?
Possibly. I've just got to do the songs and not fall over the furniture.
I just want to mention Graham Edge, who was, you know, the long time drummer and poet of the Moody's. And he sadly passed away last November.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd been with you since the beginning as well, hadn't he?
Yes. Oh, totally. Yeah. Graham was the glue that kept the whole thing together, and he loved the group more than anything. While the rest of us were moaning a lot of the time, particularly me, thinking this is rubbish. You know, well, this is a dump. I spent my life playing places. I thought this is a dump, and then, like I said before, it's 50 years later. You think, it was all brilliant. But Graham just kept the whole... He loved the group so much that he kept the whole thing together. And when he passed, it could never really be the Moody Blues without him. And I knew he was... A couple of years ago, he came to me and he said, Joss, I think I'm done, you know. I think I'm retiring. And I said, well, when you go, I'm going too, because, yeah... It was so lovely. We both remember how it was when it was just fantastic. But he was great. Lovely sounding drums Graham had. Lovely sound of them. I used to go and up Charing Cross Road and choose things with him, and he'd choose the nicest cymbals and the nicest hi-hat. And then he and I came back one night to the flat that we were sharing together, And he'd bought this lovely symbol, Zildjian symbol, and we got this punch that you could punch through whatever it is. But what are the symbols made of? Copper or brass?
Metal.
Or something,
you know?
We put rivets in it because I was looking for a really nice ride symbol. Mm-hmm. You know how precious ride symbols are.
Yeah.
And we put rivets in it that you just buy from a stationery store, and then we'd take some away, put a couple more back, wow, and you know, until we got the sound, it was.
That's amazing. That's called a sizzled symbol, isn't it? And yeah, now you can buy them.
Okay.
You could buy. Yeah. You invented the sizzled symbol as well.
Some jazzer did it. Yeah.
More to the point, why did you have something that could punch through brass? Were you planning a bank job or something?
Yeah. We were making a ride symbol.
Yeah. So when was the last time you actually played with the Moody Blues officially?
I think that was, well, it was just before, be the end of 2019. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is it solo work for you now, Justin, obviously?
Yes, I was lucky enough to do a tour last year, 2 months in America, and I've been...
You got the window. You got in the window then.
I did, September,
October. We kept missing all the windows.
Oh, did you? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, I did. I got those gigs September, October last year. Yes, and just absolutely brilliant. America, fuck yes. Sorry, Ben.
And
is that,
sorry, go on, guy.
No, I was just saying, and is that what you'd like to, are you, is that what you'd prefer to do? Do you like just doing your little, your thing, or?
I do, really. I think I've just grown up you know, I'm trying to have some dignity about things and do the songs that I've written and in the way, how I wrote it, kind of thing.
Your legacy is incredible. I said to Guy earlier.
Do it like that.
I said to Guy earlier, you're the first band ever to have a hit in 3 decades consecutively.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Surely not.
Because, yeah, a top 10. When I say a hit, I mean a top 10 in America. Because obviously, you know, when you came back with that more electro pop sound.
Yeah, yeah. And Tony Visconti.
Gemini Dream and.
Tony Visconti, yeah.
You know, whatever those. You know, again, you were having success in the MTV era.
Yeah. Yeah, we were. And we got Video of the Year once for a video called In Your Wildest Dreams, it was called.
Yeah. In Your Wildest Dreams,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Justin, it's been a real pleasure having you on.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Lovely to see you and be with you, yeah.
Yeah, it's been absolutely
you
delightful.
Too, Guy. Really big fan of you both. You know, of course. Yeah. Great.
Dear man.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure.
That was good, Guy.
Well, he's one of those lovely, his lovely, unassuming, sort of gentle people with a, you know, whose manner sort of belies his kind of his history.
Yeah. It's true, because the legacy is amazing, you know, and they've just been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and unfortunately, you know, that was
done with a huge sort of public outcry, wasn't it? But it was their fans who for years got to the point where people were just complaining. It was like they were being, you know, snubbed.
That's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah.
And it was so nice that it was done before Graham died. And what's great is, you know, this is a guy who goes all the way back to the beginning of British rock and roll with Marty Wilde.
But yeah, absolutely. It's a real bridge stuff.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back very soon with another episode of Rock on Tours. Anything else to say? We need to thank people, do we?
We need to thank Ben, always thank Ben. And more to just thank you, our loyal, well, I don't know if you're loyal, but hopefully you are, listeners. And thank you, and keep leaving your lovely reviews. Well, I haven't actually read them for a long time, so I don't know.
Yeah. now you can all run off and listen to Days of Future Past.
Yeah, exactly.
Enjoy.
Yes. Definitely. Definitely go through it. It's a great dive to go through, especially those first four albums. That four album run is amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's good night from me.
And good night from everyone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.